Welcome, everyone. I hope if you haven't done so yet that you will take a moment to take a look at who's here from all over. This is my favorite thing, or many favorite things, but one of my favorite things about teaching at Sangha Live is to feel the coming together from all over the world. So a big warm welcome to all of you. And as Faith said, we will begin our time together mostly in silence. I'll be talking, so I'll give some guided instruction. And we'll end with a bell. And after the bell, I'll talk for a little bit and then invite you to engage as you like with comments, with reflections, with questions. And then we'll go on our way. So wherever you find yourself, you could be seated on a chair or a cushion or a couch. If it's not comfortable for you to be seated, it's fine to stand or lie down. And the idea is to find a posture that allows the body to feel stable and supported. So, just beginning by making any adjustments you need to make to your posture so that you have a sense of balance, of stability, of centeredness. Helpful to have your feet, either if they're crossed or if you're on your knees or if you're in a chair on the floor. And either letting your eyes close or having a soft gaze down. And I always like to begin with a couple of deep, full breaths. Letting the chest and belly fill on the inhale, and letting it all go on the exhale. And then letting your breath return to its own natural rhythm. And feeling the length of the body, that long vertical core of the spine, it gives us a sense of uprightness, of dignity, of length, verticality. And feeling that uprightness without gripping or tension, just allowing the natural curves of the spine. Maybe checking to see that the head is balanced over the shoulders, so there's no strain or pulling in the neck or the upper back. I like to imagine I could feel a slight tug right at the crown of the head, the top of the head, just to allow the weight of the skull to have a sense of buoyancy, of uplift. And at the same time that you feel this sense of length, of verticality, letting the weight of the body, the bones, the muscles, the flesh, feel the heaviness, the earthiness of the body really sinking down, resting down. Allowing the weight of the body to rest on the earth. Letting the awareness, your attention, your consciousness fill the body. Aware of the body sitting or standing or lying. Aware of the body breathing. You don't have to make the breath happen. It's seeing what it's like to become aware of breath as sensation, wherever that's most distinct or obvious for you. Maybe at the tip of the nose or the back of the throat. The rise and fall of the chest or the ribs, the belly. Connecting with the body and the body breathing as a way to help you arrive, to be right where you are, just where you are, just as you are. Letting the awareness of breath and body bring you into the present, this moment, here. Here. And often it's useful to keep the breath and body at the center. But it's also fine, especially as you begin to feel a sense of settling, of arriving, to let your awareness open. In the same way that you receive the sensations of breath in the body, also receiving sounds. The sound of my voice, whatever ambient sound there may be where you are. Letting sounds arise and be known, and letting them go, letting them fade as they will on their own. Taking a posture and attitude of openness, of receptivity, receiving the sensations of the body and breath, opening and receiving sound. And in the same way, you can also allow thoughts to arise and be known, and letting them fade away as they will on their own. And the same with waves of feeling or emotion. Grounded, present. Resting in the body and the body breathing. Here. Opening, receiving, allowing whatever comes to arise and be known. And to fade away again and again. some of our experience is pleasant, enjoyable, we like it. Some of our experience is unpleasant. We don't like it. How is it to open, welcome, receive it all without leaning in, grabbing on, maybe getting lost in story or commentary? With no need to reject or deny or push anything away. Whatever comes, let it come and let it be known, just as it is, however it is. Whatever goes, let it go. Allowing each moment of experience to be like a cloud passing through a wide open sky. Resting, rooted, present in the body. Opening, receiving, allowing each moment, the moments we like, the moments we don't like. Letting them move through this sky-like awareness. For just this stretch of time, nowhere to go, nothing you need to do or be or become. Keeping it very simple. Each moment, just this. Moment by moment. And in this last stretch, these last minutes of our meditation practice, inviting you to imagine that you could breathe in and out of the heart or the heart center, an area at the center of the chest. Perhaps beginning by just noticing, is there a flavor, an affective tone or color to your experience? Maybe a sense of ease or contentment. Maybe some agitation or anxiety or sadness. Or quiet delight. Whatever's here, maybe one thing or a combination of things, can you receive it? Can you be with it just as it is? Without grabbing on, without pushing away. Just allowing what's here to be here and be known. And on your next inhalation, imagining you could breathe in through the heart or the heart center. And with the inhale, breathing in a sense of kindness, of tenderness, of care and compassion for yourself. And particularly if there is some difficulty or hardship in your mind or heart or body or in your life, can you breathe in this quality of care and compassion? Allow yourself to be touched by your own kindness. Continuing to breathe in through the heart. On your next exhalation, sending out these same qualities of kindness and care, tenderness and compassion to all of the others who are on this call or event together today, sending out your well wishes, your kindness and care for whatever difficulty or hardship the others may be experiencing in the mind or heart or body or life. Breathing in and breathing out through the heart center, receiving and extending tenderness, kindness, compassion. And finally, imagining that all of our collective care and compassion, all these people around the world, like to imagine it as a giant, gentle wave of loving kindness and care, and that it could move out in wider and wider circles, touching the lives of our friends and families, our colleagues, our loved ones. Touching the lives of many, many beings in all directions, seen and unseen, known and unknown, beings whose lives are impacted by COVID, by climate change, by war, by the many isms that fuel the divisiveness, hatred in our world. Touching all of those lives with this giant, gentle wave of care and compassion. And in a moment, as you hear the ring of the bell, inviting you as best you can to keep this sense of the heart open, tender, and at the same time feeling the groundedness, the presence of your body here, right where you are, wherever you are. So if you like, you're welcome to stand up and stretch or just reorient, look around the room, shake out your limbs if you like, have a sip of tea. So I would like to talk a bit today about this topic of faith, cultivating an undivided life. I am in the midst, about halfway through a month of intensive teaching here in San Francisco at the San Francisco Zen Center, where we are studying this ancient poem from someone who's regarded as the third Zen ancestor, Sung San, who lived in ancient China. And his poem, which is an expression of his understanding, his awakening, it's called the Shin Shin Ming. And there are two shins, but they are different Chinese characters. And one shin means mind, or really it's heart mind. And the second shin is translated as faith. And Shin Shin Ming is kind of a doctrine of expression of the mind, the heart mind of great faith. And I'll read you the opening lines of the poem and talk about them in a bit. But I wanted to say a little bit about Sung San, because his life for me is it's very inspiring. He didn't have an easy life. Lived his life riddled with illness, not entirely clear what kind of illness he had, Some accounts say he had leprosy, others like rheumatoid arthritis, but he struggled personally in his life. And he lived at a time when, after he came to practice out of his own struggle with his body, with his health, I have a great affinity for teachers and teachings who struggle in this way, because my own entry into practice came from years of being a person living with an illness. So I have been type 1 diabetic for almost 50 years now, from when I was a little girl. And it heartens me to know that some of these great old wise ancestors also struggled. And this poem, which I'll share with you in a little bit, is really a beautiful expression of how he found a slice of peace right in the midst of a hardship. And Sung San also lived at a time when there was some persecution of Buddhist monks. So it wasn't just that he was struggling internally, but he also lived at a time when there was a lot of difficulty in the outer world. And of course, these things are true for us as well. That we each come to practice with whatever inner struggle, inner difficulty we may bring. And we also live at a time, wherever we are. Again, we have people from all over here. We live at a time where we are, as a people, riddled with illness. We live at a time where we are daily reminded of the horror, really, of war, of violence, and where we are constantly, if we read the papers, if we pay attention in this way, we're constantly told of this amazing degree of divisiveness, of the ways in which there is not just a me and you, but an us and them, and that remarkable gap, the inability to cross the divide for us to listen, to find a place of connection, which is so essential for any of us, for all of us, actually, to survive, certainly for the planet. And so Sung San's words are inspiring for me. And I'll share some with you and then talk a bit about what I see, and then we'll hear what your thoughts, reflections are. So the opening lines of the Xinxin Ming read, "The Great Way." Sung San was deeply influenced by the Taoist tradition in China where he was. So the Great Way has this feeling of the Tao, the way, but also we might say the path of our practice, of Buddhist practice. "The Great Way," he says, "is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the slightest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind." So Sung San here is laying out for us how the mess happens, how the divide happens. And as I've been teaching this text, many, many people have said to me, what do you mean no preferences? How can you have no preferences? And I think there's a, you can see if this is true for you, but I think many people read the opening line of this poem, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. The interpretation of it becomes something like, he's telling me I shouldn't have preferences. Not what he's saying. What he's saying is that our preferences create trouble for us. And I will say that there is an alternate translation. This is a poem that has actually been translated 20 or 30 times, many, many different translations. This particular one is by Richard Clark. It's one of the most commonly recited. But there's an alternate translation in which it said, the great way is not difficult for those who are not attached to their preferences. And this is less poetic, but perhaps more accurate. So we have preferences all the time. Every moment of experience, as I pointed to in the meditation instruction, every moment of our experience, of our sensations, of our hearing, of our seeing, of our smelling, of our tasting, of our touching, of our thinking, and certainly of our interaction with what we call other. Oh, thank you. Faith just put a link to the poem for those who want to read the whole thing. So every moment of our experience is experienced by us as having one of three flavors. It's pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neutral. And in response to this valence, this coloring, the shading, the shaping of our experience, we have a reaction. If it's pleasant, we like it, we want it, we grasp, we lean in. If it's unpleasant, we don't like it. We judge it, we reject it, we push it away, we want to get rid of it. And based on the way experience is cumulative for us, that every past experience imprints our present experience, we create strategies and opinions, right? Points of view. If you, a simple example is if you take a bite of an apple, maybe 10 times, and each time you bite into an apple, you get a worm, you know, or you get a mealy, rotten apple. The next time you go to get an apple, there will be a little bit of a expectation that it will be unpleasant. And important to say that what's pleasant for you and what's unpleasant for someone else may be quite different. So the poem is not so much suggesting that we should not have preferences. It's saying that when we, I would say it this way, see and see through our preferences, when we allow them to arise without gripping, without grasping, then there's more space. We have room to breathe. And maybe more importantly, we begin to discover that spaciousness that allows us to not bang up against other points of view, which is mostly what we do. There's an image that I have used for years and just discovered that the image comes from Sung Son's Dharma sibling, someone else who was a student of the same teacher. And this Dharma brother has also a poem. And at the close of this other poem, it's described, he says, it's like we're all looking at the sky through a lead pipe, he says. And just like preferences, we can't not do that. Right? All of our moments are colored by every past moment, right? So our experience is always conditioned. So imagine that you and I and everyone else is looking at the sky through a tube, through a pipe, through a straw. And that's okay. The worst thing that you can do is to pretend that it's not the case. Oh, no. My little slice of sky is the whole sky. In other words, mine is right. Mine is better. And then when we run into someone else who's looking at a different slice of sky, maybe I see a bright blue sky as it's here in San Francisco, but we have people from around the world. And maybe for some of you, you're looking at an evening sky or a dark sky with stars or with clouds. So when we have the humility to recognize that our perspective is conditioned, it's limited, doesn't make it right or wrong, then perhaps we are willing to soften the edges of our sky circle, that we're willing to be actually interested in someone else's point of view. This is a useful instruction for our world today, where at least most of the time, I see very little of that. And less willingness to be curious, to be open, to say, how is it over there? Instead of insisting and holding on my point of view here. And I think it's important to say that this quality of openness, of curiosity, of humility in recognizing, I love this line in the poem, if you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. So it's the same idea. We all are holding opinions. I should say it differently. We all have opinions. I have very strong opinions about many things. But can I meet and connect with others who have very different opinions from me? And I don't have to agree with them. But what does it mean to be willing to listen? To recognize that my point of view, my opinions are, they're just my opinions, right? We pile on so much on top of our opinions. We create whole worlds in our opinions. We create whole identities in our opinions. And when we insist, when we hold in this way, we turn the wheel of samsara. We keep this process of self and other, us and them, in play. And this is really the, I've been describing it as the koan. Koan for me, koan for you, koan for all of us, is how do we begin to not pretend that we don't have an opinion, but how do we allow those lines to soften? To recognize that each of us carries a partial truth and that it takes all of us to see the whole sky. One of the things that we start to notice when we notice, first we notice the pleasant and unpleasant. Usually we don't notice pleasant and unpleasant. We notice I like it or I don't. And those two things are merged together for most of us. But we can start to notice when there's something that I don't like. Oh, that was unpleasant. That's all. It's just unpleasant. It's not unpleasant and I don't like it and they're wrong and I better convince them otherwise. This is our habitual reactivity, this liking and disliking. And we think that we're in charge of what we like and what we don't like. We think that we're the ones having the opinions. But all of this is conditioned. My opinions come up out of my experience, which comes out of the person I am, the place I'm in, the family I grew up in, the culture that I'm part of. And so many of us are holding views and opinions that we don't even know we have, right? Often we don't know we have it until we bang up against someone else who has something that maybe is very different. And so the idea here is not to try to get rid of our preferences or get rid of our point of view, which is that's just another preference, right? My private preference to not have preferences. I have a point of view that having a point of view is a bad idea. This is just this more of the same. And what we're invited to do is step out of the either or mind into the both and mind. I have a point of view and so do you. That we begin to shift from habitual reactivity to this seeing clearly in a way that allows us to respond to the, in some ways, unfathomable difficulties that we are facing with creativity, with fresh eyes, with fresh hearts. So that we don't just keep repeating. Because what I'm pointing to is really the root of the mess that we see all around us. We bring these views and opinions to our practice as well. And most of us carry unexplored or unexamined a bunch of ideas of what the mind should look like, or what a good practitioner looks like, or what awakening looks like. And then we're constantly checking ourselves against it and often falling short. So what I will propose to you, we have my dog barking. What I would propose to you is that instead of trying to shift the me over here or the you over there, that the whole of our practice is inviting us into an opportunity to shift our relationship between, which is a different thing. That when we practice, as we practice, what we're discovering is fundamentally a shift in perspective rather than, you know, getting what we want and getting away from what we don't want, which is pretty much what it looks like, what most of us think that, you know, if we were practicing the right way, if we were awake, that's what it would look like. A friend of mine calls the island where it all works out. We have that in the material world, and most of us just transfer that idea onto our spiritual practice. There's some idealized state where it all works out, where there's only pleasant and no longer unpleasant. And if there's unpleasant, I must be doing something wrong. And if I'm not doing something wrong, somebody else must be doing something wrong. I'll go find somebody to blame. It's one of my favorite lines toward the end of this poem. Sung San says something like, realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. There's no island where it all works out. There's just this life that we have, which includes a binary mind that is constantly reacting, constantly having preferences, liking and not liking, grasping and pushing away. But that's not all that there is. There's also this capacity to be aware of it. There is this, as I said, sky-like awareness that is able to rest. And that rest is not passivity. That rest is non-reactivity, so that we can respond, so that we can respond in ways that don't just keep making it worse, keep repeating the same thing over and over. So I'm going to stop talking in a few minutes, but I want to read you a poem that came up this morning because I have this dog who is behind me. You can't see, but I have a dog that barks a lot. And I was wondering, is he going to start barking during my, you know, event today online? And this is a poem that speaks about a barking dog as an example. You can fill in your own version of an unpleasant experience, and describes how it is that we can have this shift in perspective so that our relationship to our experience can change, can transform in surprising ways. And life will always allow us to discover surprise if we're willing to let go of that tight grip. Because life itself is alive. It's fresh. And we get so tight and insistent, holding, that we miss the chance to discover something new. So yes, somebody's asking in the chat. This is a poem by Billy Collins. And it's called "Another Reason Why I Don't Keep a Gun in the House." And I bet somebody out there can find a link to post it. But for now, you could just listen as I read. Another reason why I don't keep a gun in the house. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. This is unpleasant, right? So whatever it is for you, whatever unpleasant experience you have, an annoying neighbor, pain in the body, pain in the heart, right? You can fill in your own blank here. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. He is barking the same high rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on their way out. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony full blast. Unpleasant experience, reaction, right? Get rid of it. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony full blast. But I can still hear him muffled under the music, barking, barking, barking. And here's the turn. And now I can see him sitting in the orchestra, his head raised confidently, as if Beethoven had included a part for barking dog. When the record finally ends, he is still barking, sitting there in the oboe section, barking. His eyes fixed on the conductor who is entreating him with his baton. While the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous barking dog solo, that endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius. While the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous barking dog solo, that endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius. This is such potent Dharma instruction. We have the ancient poem from Sun San, and here we have a more modern poem, which is pointing us toward how do we relate to whatever it is that registers for us as unpleasant, without taking out a gun, without having to do harm to whoever it is or whatever it is that we think is causing trouble. How can we shift our relationship to our experience in a way that allows us to see it fresh? There's a hint here. The other musicians are listening in respectful. To respect is re is again, and spect is like spectacle, spectacles like glasses. And to respect means to look again. It's the invitation to stay close to our life, to step out of our habitual reactivity, to discover that space between the subject and the object, to discover the threads of connectivity that allow us to respond in a more creative way. So we don't just keep the wheel of harm, of anger, of violence turning, but we discover that we can respond in different ways. I'm looking at the clock. So I will pause. Thanks, Charlesley, for posting the poem. And invite thoughts, reflections, questions. As Faith said at the opening, you can better, instead of typing into the chat, to there's should be a little bar at the bottom of your screen that says ask a question. So you can type your question into the ask a question box, and I'll give a few moments for folks to type in. And also you can type into the ask a question box a wish to ask your question live, not just type. And then Faith will connect with you and bring you on screen so that we can have, I don't know if it's exactly live conversation, but something more than me responding to words. So I, my hope is that these words that I have offered from these, again, ancient and modern poems will be food for thought in a way, will prompt you to consider how to first pay attention and notice the constant reverb of pleasant and unpleasant, liking and not liking. And to consider that as we see our preferences, as we see our opinions, that we can also begin to see through them. We don't have to get rid of them, but we have to have this humility of recognizing, oh, that's my opinion. Most of our opinions, as I said, are conditioned from our past. And sometimes that's helpful in the present, and sometimes not so much. And as we take on this practice, this humbling practice of recognizing this constant liking and disliking, preferring and opining, then we can begin to shift our relationship to our opinions to start with, to go, oh, okay, this is my opinion, and what else is possible? We can begin to have some alternate options in how to respond, which I think we are in desperate need of in our world today. So I see one person, Kathy, who would like to come on screen. So that will take a couple moments, I believe. And I'm looking in the ask a question box, but I don't see any questions yet. Let me see. Oh, I see some. Let me come to that in a moment. Kathy, hi. I know Kathy from when she lived in San Francisco. Nice to
Hi,
see you.
can you hear
Hi.
me okay?
I can, yeah.
Thank you so much. I was so excited. And if Anita is on here, thank you, Anita, a friend of mine in the UK, sent me an email and said, oh, Pam's going to be giving a talk because I had shared her book, your book with her. So thank you, Anita, for letting me know Pam was going to be on. I love the talk. That Shin Shin Ming, I mean, yeah, that question about the preferences, like, how can I not have preferences? My husband and I actually were, we were having a lively exchange of preferences this morning. And then talking afterwards about, how do we not get so attached? So that was a great, that was a great reminder of you don't have to get rid of them, but just, can you soften around them? But what I was really excited about to hear you speak about was when I saw the title had faith in it. And I'm
Oh, I
wondering,
didn't say so much about
yeah, I
that,
was wondering if you could talk a
did
little bit about faith because yeah, I feel like I'm really being tested in faith right now. So I'd love if you could tell me more about that.
Oh, yes, I forgot that part. So, all of what I have been talking about is pointing us to faith. And faith means, so in much of the Western or certainly the Judeo-Christian tradition, we have faith in something out there. That's one way of talking about it. And sometimes we turn that around, certainly in a lot of Western psychology, and we're told to have faith in something in here. And this faith is something different. This is, I would describe as the faith in the thing in between subject and object, which is a mystery. It's this alive, fluid connectivity, the thing that holds all of it, all of us, that I would call, if I had to give it a word, love. And I think for many of us, this faith is being tested, right? If you listen only to the headlines or the news or whatever, wherever you are, it becomes very difficult to feel like I can let my guard down, I can relax back, right? And so in that way, even more important to give ourselves access to this creative life force that's always here. And when we are willing to allow the grip of our views and opinions to soften, something else comes in. But we can't, for the most part, experience that very well until we release the grip, right? We see that we're gripping, and then we go, oh. And then the creativity and the innate goodness and love of life itself will come. But that's tricky for us to do. And that faith in something that I can't get, that I can't hold, that I can't, it's a mystery. It's inviting us to remember that life itself is bigger than my views of it, right? And I think that when we're in difficult times, the tendency is to do the opposite, to hold tighter. I think that's a lot of what we see in our sort of public discourse, and also in the violence that's happening, so many ways in the world. And so we are doing our part to stop the war, if you will, by remembering this isn't the only option, right? That we soften our straw circle and say, oh, sky. Ah, right. And we allow something new, something fresh to come in. So, a long answer. I don't know if it answers your question.
No, it really does help, actually, that reminder that it's not like, oh, faith in, that it's not inside.
Yes,
that's not right. Like that. That's really helpful to remember that it's relational. So
it's relational, and it is mysterious, and it is alive. So faith in many traditions is projected out into some higher self or higher being. And this faith is more like the mind, the big mind, meaning the awareness itself as of great faith, is the mind that reveals itself when we don't hold on so tightly. I sometimes use this other metaphor of, I've been using sky, but there's another metaphor that is popular in Buddhism where there's this phrase about entering the stream. We enter the stream as a kind of seeing, clear seeing of things as they are. And I always think it's more like becoming the stream, that we allow ourselves to enter into our fluid, alive river nature, you know, rather than insisting that we hold ourselves in our tight little cubes of, you know, ice cube tray. And I like the metaphor of the ice cube tray because it suggests to us that our task is to soften and melt, right? The water is here, but we've held it so tightly that we're all in our little boxes, and then those boxes bang up against each other. So can we soften into something that's already here? We don't have to go get it, go find it, create it. We just open. And that's our practice. That's what we're doing in our practice in this simplified environment of meditative practice, is reminding ourselves, oh, I can allow things to come and go rather than grabbing and pushing away. And I'm, it's okay. Not only is it okay, it's enlivening, right? Like that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Great. I'm going to go to the question box. When we look at things, life, thoughts without preferences, we can discover the observer. That brings a great relief to befriend with the observer. Yeah. So when we look at life without preferences, we can begin to see that there's something aware that is not, that's beyond those preferences. And yes, we can befriend that part of us. We can actually discover that part of us in our practice, in our direct experience. I have one other person who says they'd like to come on live. Let me just, you can go ahead, Faith, and bring Kate on. And someone else is asking, are these poets suggesting that we learn to accept all the various opinions and preferences, but not try to change things? No, I think it's really important. It can sound so easily like, okay, don't have opinions and preferences and just allow whatever's happening to happen as a kind of passivity. And I don't think that that's what's being pointed to at all. I think that what's being pointed to is the invitation for us to step out of our habitual reactivity, the churn, just like Kathy was saying, if we get into an argument, we hold our views, and then we're stuck. And instead, to be able to come up with a fresh response. So it's not that we don't do anything. It's just that by relating to our experience in a different way, we can come up with fresh or creative responses, which is, you know, sort of in a humorous way, in a way what the second poem was pointing to, right? So we can learn to relate to our experience in a different way that allows a fresh response. And I think if there was any question at any time that there's something we need now, we could use a fresh response, right? Because the same damn responses are just recycling over and over. We see the same issues, right? Things swing to one side and then they react and they swing to the other. And meanwhile, so much harm. It's not a small problem. There are lives that are harmed, whether they're lives that are being harmed in a war or lives that are being harmed in the United States with ongoing violence, gun violence. So these teachings are pointing us to the source of where this kind of difficulty, this divisiveness comes from. And it's actually showing us a way to change things that's not just making it worse, not just adding in, but it's not to not do anything. That's really important. All right. Do we have Kate? Are you ready for Kate? Can't tell. Oh, okay. Maybe Kate decided not to come on. So someone else here is asking, can you speak a bit about the influence of both Zen and insight and what that looks like on the cushion? How do you decide when to do a Zazen practice versus a Vipassana practice? Curious how that looks for you. So I want to be very clear that you hear my response as my experience and my opinion. And I say that because what I'm saying isn't right. It's not the way. I'm just speaking from what's been true for me. When I started my practice, my first 10 years or so, I was quite a dedicated and somewhat zealous Zen student. And that was not a bad thing. It was actually life-saving in many ways for me. And I loved the teaching, as I still do. And the thing that I discovered was that stepping out of that and going into something that was a different style that I had some views and opinions about initially, meaning my way, the Zen way is the better way and everything else is sort of second class, right? So I got to discover for myself that that wasn't true. That what's true is that there are these very complementary and both powerful ways of engaging that have a tremendous amount of overlap, right? So for me, the most important piece of it was that the stepping out of Zen helped me soften up those tight views and opinions. A simple way to talk about what to do on the cushion is that there is in the insight tradition quite a lot of instruction about how to practice, what you do with your, you know, when I sit in Zazen, I don't give instruction. When I do something like this, as you got earlier, there's instruction for how to practice. They both end up in the same place, which is this kind of posture which is what's emphasized in Zen, a physical posture of stability and then openness and receptivity. There's more instruction about how to do that in the insight tradition. And in Zen, because of the nature of that practice, it's a bit more like apprenticeship. You learn by observing. You learn by watching the people around you, by engaging in community. So I used to always say that in Zen practice, there's a lot of external form and instruction, and the inside is wide open. Whereas in insight tradition, there's actually not a lot of form externally. You can sit or stand or lie down or whatever you do, but there's quite a bit of structure internally. So both have a kind of framework, and both have space for you being you. And so I think for me, it depends a little bit on what feels appropriate or most useful in a moment. If I'm in a community that is quite structured, then I have more space to be wide open at the center without just spacing out, you know. If I am in a situation that doesn't have a lot of external structure, then it can be very useful, kind actually, for me to give myself more specific internal instruction. So in the insight tradition, we work primarily with the four foundations of mindfulness. So both of them have a degree of structure and a degree of spaciousness. And I think that that's useful because we need both. And it's for each of us to kind of, regardless if it's Zen or Vipassana, but it's for each of us as we move through our practice, whether it's a single sitting or our life of practice, that in the spirit of what I've been saying, we don't want to get too attached to one way, but that our practice itself is alive. And sometimes it looks like this for a while, and sometimes later it will shift shape and form a bit. So I don't know if that is response, if that answers your question, Brian, but I appreciate the topic. Yes. He's nodding and smiling, he says. So, okay. And we're still trying to get Kate on live. Yeah. So I will say, while we're waiting a little bit more about this question that Kathy brought up about faith. And faith is the word in the Pali tradition is Shraddha. And it's sometimes faith is one word. It's also described sometimes as a confidence. And the confidence, again, is not so much I'm confident in what's out there or I'm confident in what's in here, but it's a faith points us to a kind of confidence in the basic goodness of life itself. And the understanding that when we begin to release the grip of our trying to manage and control and strategize, that what comes through, that life itself, well, it's alive. It is vital. It is good. I'm vamping a little bit while we're trying to see if we can get someone else online. And if there are other questions, we only have a little bit of time left, but please, or comments. It's when we see and see through. So I think important to say when we see our opinions and preferences that we don't slap ourselves on the hand, right? You don't say, oh no, I have preferences. This is what I was trying to say at the beginning. He's not saying the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. He's pointing us to something that when those preferences release, things are not so difficult. He is not saying you, whoever you are, in whatever country you're calling in from, should not have preferences. That's not what he's saying. But we assume, you know, somehow that that's what it means. But our practice is actually to see those preferences. Our practice is actually to recognize that we are constantly in the midst of opining, of having opinions about things. And as we see that, we don't have to judge ourselves for it. We see it. That's the doorway that allows us to say, oh, that's just the view. And I mean, I have points of view, very strong. If I hold them, if I insist on them, I suffer. Someone is saying, oh, okay. Looks like we're not going to get Kate on. I will read the question. My neighbor has very loud music in her garden for about 10 hours a day and shouts throughout to her husband about how she hates everyone. Oof, I cannot get any peace or quiet. How would you suggest dealing with this? So I'm sorry first for your situation. So this is, there is the subject, that would be you. There is the object, that would be this person. And there is this thing in between that you're noticing, which is your relationship to it, which is don't like, don't like, don't like, don't like. So the first step is to peel the attention off of the object and to start to pay attention to that reverb. Because it is unpleasant, that's true. But your resistance and judgment, etc., is just piling on. So it's not that you shouldn't do something, but the first thing is to do is to notice and pay attention to the various ways in which you are resisting, judging, resenting, etc. And not to judge yourself for that, but just to actually feel what that part is like. Not the what's happening out there, but your reaction to it. And as you sit with that, not justifying it, not rejecting it, but being with it, it begins to clarify. And as that begins to clarify, ideally, you will begin to see some other options. And I can't promise you that what I'm going to tell you will make it work out. Not what I'm going to tell you. I can't promise you that if you do that, it's going to work out, meaning the woman's going to stop shouting and turn off her loud music. But I will say that you may find a different kind of response, just like the Billy Collins did in his poem. And that in your response, you may find a creative solution to how to engage. And I don't know what that is, right? We all of us are being faced with things we don't like that are quite difficult all the time. So we work with our part of it, meaning we work with our relationship to it. And that reverb of liking and not liking, we quiet that down enough that we can begin to see some options. This is our practice. And it's tricky, I only have about another minute, because so often I feel people come to me as a Dharma teacher and say, what should I do? What should I do? And rarely is me telling you what to do useful, because I'm not you. And also because I can tell you what to do in this situation, perhaps, and then there's the next one, and then there's the next one. So what I'm trying to do is point you toward a way of relating to your difficulty, not just you, but all of us, that will allow a creative response to come through you. And again, it doesn't mean it's going to work out, but your relationship to what's happening can transform. I think it's helpful to know that, you know, everything didn't work out for the Buddha either. There are all kinds of difficult experiences that he had. So we have an imagination that if we just practice the right way, we can get things to go the way we want. I don't think so. Right? But we do the best we can. And we do the best we can to not take out a gun and go after the woman in the, at the house next door, but to take those difficulties and use our practice to learn something, to discover something, to consider what kind of shift in perspective we might have, rather before we go to what do I do? We'll say one more thing about this and then stop, which is that very often, in my experience, what needs to happen before I do something is that I need to feel something. What I mean by that is I may need to feel how pissed off I am. I may need to feel how despairing I am. And when I allow myself to feel the feeling, not to believe it, not to reject it, but to allow it, then again, often there's a kind of freshness that can come in my response. So we are at the end. And I'll just take a moment to thank you all. See your thank yous coming on the chat for coming. And just inviting me and you and all of us to feel whatever questions, whatever insights, whatever inspiration may have come from our coming together, and breathing that in. And on the exhale, sending it out, offering any goodness, any merit, any benefit that may have come from our gathering today. May that be freely and generously shared for the reduction of greed, hatred, and delusion, for the overcoming of divisiveness. May we offer the goodness for the healing of our world. By the power and truth of our practice together, may we, together with all beings, awaken to the truth and beauty of who we are. And may we discover our true nature, our sky-like, river-like nature, and be free. Thank you all very much. Please take good care of yourselves, and I'll see you the next time.